Hey everyone, if you love listening to Curbsiders and want to enhance the experience, then now is a great time to join the Curbsiders Patreon with new annual memberships where you can save 10% off the monthly rate. You'll have the option to hear all the episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes. You can sign up at patreon.com/curbsiders. This is a great way to use that CME money that's probably burning a hole in your pocket, plus support the show so we can keep bringing you clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, mini-series like Teach and Addiction Medicine, our Digest newsletter, and of course, expand our video content. So join the Cashlack family today at patreon.com/curbsiders.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts. It should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Hey, Natalie. It's so good to see you tonight.
It's good to see you, too.
It's nice, too, that we are on video. So for those of you who are interested in knowing what we look like, you can check it out on YouTube. But something that I was reminded of today when I was staring at your face on video was that during the pandemic, when Natalie and I were co-fellows, we both have dark curly hair, which would frequently confuse our patients with our masks on.
Because we would alternate often, you know, between the hospital and the clinic, and people would have very little idea of which of us was which. But it was fine because you were a very kind doctor, and it was always a compliment when people thought I was you. I'd say, yes, she's very nice, but that was not actually me.
My favorite time was when somebody combined our names together, like staring me in the eye. And I was like, I knew it was going through their brain. They're like, Dr. Stahl Chan. I was like, close enough. I will accept either.
Curly hair. Yep.
Yes. But on that note, welcome back to the Curbsiders, our new mini series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and I'm joined tonight by Dr. Natalie Stahl. And today we have really a great episode for you. It is full of so many practical pearls. I can't wait to share it with you as we talk about urine drug testing with Dr. Tim Wiegand. But before we get too much into this, Natalie, will you remind folks what we do here?
Sure, Carolyn. So we are the Addiction Medicine Podcast that uses expert interviews to demystify common addiction medicine topics, reduce stigma, and inspire listeners to be fierce advocates for all individuals who use substances. A reminder that most episodes are available for free CME credit that through VCU Health CE, that's for all health professionals, and go to curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And also, by listening to these episodes and the completing the CME, you can use it to count towards the new DEA 8-hour requirement on substance use disorders education.
And special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM. They have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Med series. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction med faculty and trainees, and they were absolutely dedicated to training and supporting the next generation of academic addiction medicine leaders. And whether you're an addiction med doc preparing for the ABPM board exam or a physician in practice who just wants to learn more about the addiction medicine field, ACAM offers several self-study products that help meet your needs. They have a professional practice bundle that includes access to 86 self-assessment modules that provide CME, as well as 46 didactic lecture recordings. ACAM's board prep bundle also offers access to the 46 didactic lecture recordings, along with a nearly 200-item question bank and its addiction e-practice test. To learn more about these and other product offerings, as well as membership opportunities, be sure to visit acam.org.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Tim Wiegand. Dr. Wiegand is a medical toxicologist and addiction specialist and director of addiction medicine at the University of Rochester Medical Center, where he founded the Toxicology and Addiction Consult Service. He moderates the Addiction Toxicology Case Conference. It's held the first Friday of every month from 1 to 2 Eastern Standard Time. He'll tell us more about that. His particular areas of interest are in the bedside care of intoxication and withdrawal, pain treatment and perioperative management, low-dosing buprenorphine and OUD, drug testing application interpretation, and toxicology, addiction, and pharmacology education. So today, he'll teach us a lot of things, but some pearls are the differences between screening and confirmatory testing, common false positives, and also common things that can cross-react and look like positives. They're just somewhat different from false positives, as he tells us. And also how to talk to your patients about the results that you see, especially when they're unexpected.
So I will never further ado. Oh, I said I'll never look at sertraline the same the same way.
I know. Again. I will not. Sertraline. I was very suspicious of bupropion before, and now I'm going to be much more suspicious of sertraline. So without further ado, let's get to it.
Hey, Tim, we're really excited to have you on the show today and just really appreciative that you're willing to spend your evening with us. We just want to start with a couple of rapid fire questions just to get to know you a little bit better. So do you mind giving us a one-liner to describe yourself?
Sure. I'm a 32-year-old. Now I'm actually 50. I'm a medical toxicologist, addictionologist, husband, father of three. Love good sushi. It has to be really good sushi, not just like store-bought or suburban. And I collect Golden Age horror comics.
How did you get into collecting comics?
My dad had some comics when he was growing up, and he saved them as a kid. And I also lived down the street from a grocery store that had comic books. As the typical kid going down to the grocery store, reading them in the rack and then bringing them home. And I love to read. I love the visual field. And so there's a combination of some of these old comics and getting to see some at the grocery store. I just kind of fell in love with them. And then there was a comic shop in the city I grew up in, and they had older comics. I liked the horror ones in particular, things that were pretty graphic that I hadn't seen before. So I fell in love with them and have been collecting for quite a while.
I didn't grow up reading comics, but as an adult, I've learned more about graphic novels and fell in love with a few graphic novels. And I think it was a very underappreciated part of my, I think in childhood, I would have liked comics a lot more if I'd been introduced to them in the right way.
Yeah. I like graphic novels and Mouse and there's some great books out there.
There are. Can you tell us a bit about your favorite aspects of working in addiction medicine? What keeps you in this field?
Well, there's a lot of things that really interest me. I think the most important is you can have a dramatic impact on someone's life. And this is really just by being sincere and practicing medicine well, knowing the science and working well with patients. ASAM, American Society of Addiction Medicine, one of the says, treat addiction, save lives, and it's really true. And working with patients over time, you can have such an impact, not just acutely, whether it's in the ED or hospital setting. I work very commonly in the consult service in the hospital and the ED and really influence the outcome, make them more comfortable, help them stay, help them, their care is dramatically impacted. But, the re-engagement with family life as the substance use disorder addiction is treated and stabilizes, it's just really rewarding to see.
I totally agree. Within medicine and a lot of other chronic disease management, I don't necessarily always immediately see that instant gratification. If someone's A1C improves, it's wonderful, it's great. But there's nothing like watching somebody just sort of reconnect with their family members as their substance use disorder is treated and just sort of like live life more on their own terms, which is really great to see.
Yeah, living life more fully, health comes back, re-engage with family. I also really like teaching addiction medicine and how it intersects with other medical specialties, I'm a medical toxicologist, and it's been really rewarding working with other medical toxicologists to try and help them incorporate it into their practice. There's an awful lot of natural overlap, and in fact, the two specialties in fellowship training have been combined and shortened the fellowship training from doing them both separately, and recognition that there's a lot of overlap. But med tox is a small specialty, mostly people practicing at hospital settings, academic centers, and expanding their practice and taking care of really important area treatment of substance use disorder and addiction in the hospital setting. And I started incorporating it into my toxicology practice, and I've had a lot of other colleagues follow suit as well.
Yeah, it's definitely cool that there's no wrong door and that there's so many specialties that can be involved, right? For those of you out there who aren't sure, of how to become certified in addiction medicine, you can do it from pretty much any field now, right? You can correct me if I'm wrong, but emergency medicine, internal medicine, surgery, I think family medicine, pediatrics, there's so many ways. It's great to see and like work with people as well who have like such a different knowledge base than you, because I think it just really enhances the care that we provide.
Absolutely.
And on that note, Natalie, do you want to kick us off with our case from Cashlack Memorial?
Sure. So here's the case from Cashlack. Mr. Z is a 43-year-old gentleman So he has a past medical history of opioid use disorder. He's currently on buprenorphine. He has anxiety. He's on chronic clonazepam and benzodiazepine. He recently had an unintentional overdose that was complicated by compartment syndrome and that required a fasciotomy. So he was discharged from the hospital about 5 days ago with a prescription for oxycodone for acute pain, in addition to his buprenorphine, which was continued appropriately in the hospital, and also his clonazepam. He presents to your office with continued assistance for pain management, and you're anticipating that part of that management is going to involve drug screening of some kind. So to kind of take a step back and introduce us to this topic, there's different types of drug screens, urine drug screens, and it can get a little confusing. So what's the difference between a point of care screening, confirmatory drug screens? Like what's the difference between them? What are the advantages and disadvantages of them? And how do we choose kind of where we start in these kinds of situations?
Those are good questions, and you have a lot of them all packaged into one. So let me do my best. I'll try and answer the screening. A screening is sometimes called preliminary, presumptive, initial, also sometimes called point of care, or point of care can be a screening test. This is usually the initial test. It usually has a specific panel of analytes or substances that should be regionally important. It uses antibody technology, so antibodies have been developed to the chemicals. When you have the substance in the medium, so let's say this is a urine test, a screening urine test, it would be trigger a positive, be an antibody reaction. Common panel may include THC, benzodiazepines, opiates, opioids, amphetamines, methamphetamine, barbiturates, cocaine, may or may not have a couple of more things on there. These are done usually as initial tests. The results can be obtained pretty quickly. If it's a point of care screening test, you can get that in your office if you're doing it yourself. You know, those are the typical urine cups or the dipsticks that if you interpret them, you can get the result there. If you're doing this in an emergency department or an office or a hospital setting, that's going to be sent down to the lab. They're going to run it and interpret it. It's much less expensive than the confirmatory tests. I mentioned easy to do. Some of the disadvantage, the antibody reacts to a specific chemical, which has a specific structure, but for some of the analytes, there's other drugs and substances out there that could cross-react, so you could get a false positive. That doesn't happen with everything, but some common drugs or classes of medications, the analytes that have false positives are going to be amphetamines. Benzodiazepines can cross-react. Some drugs can cross-react with the screen. Sertraline. Others less commonly so, but you run the risk of false positive. Rather than really being a disadvantage in that, you know, it's a screening test, people need to really understand how to interpret these and really what can cause a false positive and what's tested for in their specific panel and then what might be left off. I see more problems with somebody not realizing an opioid isn't included under the opiate screen, for example. Fentanyl, methadone, or buprenorphine aren't actually included under opiates than really misinterpretation or, you know, misinterpretation due to a false positive.
That part, it seems like the office, the point of care is often the same as the screening test you might get in terms of the science, that the point of care is scientifically similar to what you'd send to your lab. Yes. For a quick screening test. And they're more prone to have some false positives that you should just be aware, you know, that you should know maybe which ones are more common and be aware that they can exist. And also there's some things that are not on there that are not on your typical, our standard screening test that we should always be aware of as well. And I think the other part of the question is, how does a confirmatory test work? How is it different? And what rules of thumb do you decide when you need a confirmatory test or not, since it is more expensive and takes more time?
Good. So the confirmatory test is the other part of that. That's usually the second step. This is different methods. So usually chromatography, gas chromatography or liquid chromatography, which is much more involved. takes more time and more expensive, takes more experience. It's typically paired with something called mass spectroscopy. So I can go into more detail, but the chromatography part will tell you what substance is there based on a retention time. And then the mass spectroscopy kind of breaks it apart and gives you the fingerprint of the drug. And so you can differentiate between, amphetamine compared with something that looks structurally like amphetamine, but it's just a little different, like pseudoephedrine or bupropion. You can quantify, get specific levels of the drug. The downsides, these are expensive tests. They take some time. You're not going to have a false positive, so you're going to be able to use this to determine is a positive truly a positive, and maybe at what level, or is it not the substance that you're looking for. I use the confirmatory tests when it's going to impact the patient care, not just to find out if a drug is there or not, but it has some meaning. And that's usually if, there's some legal issues potentially, if I'm in the outpatient setting, maybe it's a case where CPS is involved, a child got into a medication or a drug test, found something, positive. I'm trying to determine, is this a positive from, illicit drug, or is it a positive because it's a false positive cross-reacting with some of the cough and cold medicine maybe that the child got from a parent. Confirmatory tests are really important in certain monitoring programs like the physician health or pilot health programs. The professionals enroll in the programs really for advocacy and are undergoing random urine tests a couple of times a month. If a positive comes up, you really want to know, is that a true positive or false positive? False positive. So really important to confirm and determine if it's really there. Sometimes I use the confirmatory testing for compliance, like with medication, like buprenorphine. We'll talk maybe a little bit about urine buprenorphine levels later on, but quantifying the metabolite levels can help me determine or differentiate between someone spiking the urine with buprenorphine or actually taking it. Can help me anticipate changes in administration that might mean someone's trying to self-taper or coming off or change the way that they're using it, or it can help me confirm compliance and really be just part of the overall reinforcement to the patient that I see your levels of buprenorphine are great. You've been doing really well with your program. It sounds like family's really happy. You're really happy. Your levels are good. So that feedback can be really important for the patient. I use that with ethyl glucuronide or ethyl sulfate when I'm treating someone that has alcohol use disorder with naltrexone, or maybe they underwent an ambulatory detox protocol, and I'm using that the week after to just reinforce, probably what I already know with the patient, if they've slipped up and told me, or if they've been doing really well. Even if the patient knows it, sometimes that support or confirmation is really useful. So just those are some of the situations where I might use a confirmatory test or quantify and use them to help impact patient care.
And I think on that end, too, in my practice, a huge thing before I even order one is really just having that discussion with the patient, too. Like, hey, I'm here to support you and how you want to be supported. I'm not going to kick you out of clinic based on X. I'm just here to try and help support you and keep you safe. These are a controlled substance. There can be like harms and risks associated with it, right? So this is just part of the routine monitoring, that we do. As well as I have found it, especially now in the era of having a lot of substances contaminated with fentanyl, even as a harm reduction tool, where I can actually show a patient what they took. And if they're like, wow, I really didn't think I took or was exposed to fentanyl, but if it comes up in their urine, all of a sudden we can have a conversation about that and where it possibly could have come from and what we can do to sort of like reduce the risk of being exposed unintentionally, as well to other substances.
Yeah, those are great points. The fentanyl in particular, I've had in particular younger teens, younger adults, sometimes with counterfeit pills. Sometimes they even know that they've gotten a counterfeit pill, but to hear that they've had fentanyl in their system, it can be really sobering and really important to let somebody know. It's like, I never would have used fentanyl intentionally. But it's also important to understand what's not included and what you can't test for. You know, I've had, as a toxicologist, I've had other providers call and say, we've ruled out an overdose because of the urine tox screen is negative. Well, you've ruled out, you know, four or five things that the patient may have taken clinically. So there's a lot of limitations, and I see misinterpretation all of the time. And you mentioned something also about engaging the patient, letting them know why you're using the drug tests. And I like, that's really important to set that up at the start so people don't feel that either they're being singled out, why, so they can anticipate how it's being done, how you use them in clinical practice. And I think another great point, it's not an all or none. Positive means this, a negative is that. I'm going to stop your medication. It's just part of the overall information, just, you know, used along with a lot of other information.
And I think the fentanyl is a great example of how important that conversation is and how the type of test you're doing matters so much, because there's a lot of facilities where fentanyl isn't on the default, where that's a very big problem if people are overdosing from unintentional exposure in the stimulant supply. You know, so sometimes people need to know to add it if it's not already the default in their institution. And I think along the same lines, where I've worked, there's been only fentanyl for a very long time, and it stays in people's systems even when they've stopped using for it takes quite a while for their screening test to clear entirely. Sometimes if they were using heavily, so their first test might still be positive for fentanyl. And so with a confirmatory test, you might be able to track changes over time. But otherwise, they might, if we were interpreting it the wrong way, or we weren't giving them warning ahead of time of what we're looking for and why, you know, people might feel a certain way about having something that's still positive on the screening test, you know, even if they haven't used in the last few days. So I think that knowledge ahead of time of saying this is only as good as how you interpret it and what it means, you know, so is a great and important point.
Yeah, I've had that conversation with counselors and others, in particular about fentanyl people. It's only recently that people really understood how long that can stay positive if somebody's using, any substance that has fentanyl, typically, you know, heroin that has the fentanyl in it, but that can stay positive for quite a long period of time, weeks to several weeks. So yeah, really important on how you interpret and understand it.
This probably leads well actually into our next question. Like, what is a typical window to detect a substance in a urine test?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there's a lot of variability. I was just talking with some students about this earlier today. And in general, if you have a single use of almost every substance, almost most substances, a single small amount of use, a puff on a pipe with THC, a small line of cocaine, same thing with amphetamine, 1 to 3 days. But the window of detection depends a lot on then frequency of use, if it's more than a single use, how much is used, the specific drug, and then individual patient characteristics. Two examples of that, we've already mentioned one, would be fentanyl. Fentanyl is a really lipid-soluble drug. If it's used repeatedly, it starts to build up in someone's lipid stores and their fat. If you give somebody fentanyl for a colonoscopy and check their urine 48 hours later, and most people it's already gone from that single administration. But if you have somebody that's using heroin adulterated with fentanyl over a protracted, prolonged period of time, I think they're using 10 times a day, maybe 5-6 times a day, you'll be able to detect that for weeks, if not even a month. There's a recent study that showed when you check the urine for fentanyl and its metabolite, and patients that have been admitted to a locked inpatient unit for 28 days, some of the patients will still have positive urines for fentanyl 28 days later. Most people will be negative about halfway through, but it's very different than just testing after that single use, which is, you know, 1 to 3 days. THC is another one that's really common in terms of the changes if somebody's using it over periods of time. I've had patients that are positive for months, which gets into, in the past, law enforcement, probation, parole would be much more concerned about cannabis use and really want to see use dropping in somebody that was in drug court or probation over periods of time. And we'd have to do THC to creatinine ratios, which could show drops and the creatinine standardized for urine concentration drops over time compared with just kind of a single level of use. We could see it positive for quite a long period of time in somebody that had been heavy user and had a lot of lipid store. Also, one of the other thing that I was going to mention is the medium really is important. Like oral fluid or saliva will pick up THC only for about 48 hours, 40 to 72 hours, even in a heavy user. So even, which can be really useful. If you know somebody stopped using or you think they stopped using and they had been a heavy user previously, it may be really useful just to do an oral fluid or saliva just to say, no, it's not positive today. That can come up important in a couple of different situations. Whereas you have a positive from urine screen, it's in particular, if it's just the screening test, not telling you how much level, it really, that can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. And then hair could pick up a positive hair test. I don't really use hair very often, and there's a variety of different reasons for that, but that can give you a positive over the length of the hair, which on average is about 3 months. The average hair length is about 1.5 inches, and so about 90 days if there's a positive test. So it can get tricky with hair.
Going back to the case quickly of, he's on oxycodone, and this was a case where you're going to send for confirmatory testing. So you had mentioned already, first of all, that the screen for opiates doesn't include everything, so like what's on the screening test, what's on opiates or opioids? And then when you send in the opioid screen for confirmation, like what comes back and how do you interpret that?
That's an involved question. Let me see if I can break that apart. So we have on the screening test, we have a couple of different things that you can, they're typically on it. In most of the settings I'm practicing, we will have opiates, oxycodone, or sometimes called an opioid screen. Sometimes it's also labeled oxycodone. And then you can look for other specific opioids sometimes, depending on the screening panel. You can check for fentanyl. And I believe our patient also had a fentanyl positive screen, did he not? And then also methadone or buprenorphine and even tramadol in some screens. So it really depends on what else is on there. The opiate screen is going to pick up opiates. And opiates are chemicals that came from the poppy and their metabolites, and then some other opioids that are very structurally close to the opiates. So our opiate screen is codeine, morphine, the old heroin, which is diacetylmorphine. It's metabolized into monoacetylmorphine and morphine. That'll be picked up by the opiate screen. And then the synthetic opioids that are very close to opiates are hydrocodone and hydromorphone. Hydromorphone is Dilaudid, hydrocodone is Vicodin, and those could be picked up under the opiate screen. And then if you have a quantification, so if you had several opioids show up, that can get challenging to interpret because it really depends on what is showing up. Some of the opioids are metabolites of each other. Codeine, for example, is turned into morphine. So if you had codeine and morphine show up, it could be because somebody was taking codeine. It could also be because they're using codeine and morphine. If someone had been using historically heroin, I don't see this as much in my area anymore, but maybe 5-10 years ago, I would see codeine, morphine, monoacetylmorphine, and then hydromorphone sometimes. And that could all be from heroin use with the diacetylmorphine. The codeine is because often small amounts of codeine from the processing from the poppy to opium, codeine was left. Really high levels of morphine can actually turn into some hydromorphone as metabolites, the small amounts of hydromorphone. But unless you're really quantifying that, this could be a patient that's using the heroin, or they could be, if monoacetylmorphine is present, you'd say, well, this is from heroin, or it could be someone that's using morphine, hydromorphone, codeine all together. So you get, you have to really interpret it in terms of the context. And then the opioid screen or oxycodone, that'll pick up oxycodone. And then if you confirm that, you could have oxycodone. And then a common metabolite of oxycodone is oxymorphone, which is the active opioid in Opana, which is not uncommon as a strong opioid that's used for chronic pain. If you have oxycodone and oxymorphone, it could be because it's just from the oxycodone that's metabolized, or it could be the individual's using both oxymorphone and oxycodone. Fentanyl, if fentanyl shows up, if it's confirmed, it's truly fentanyl. But as the immunoassay or the initial screen, fentanyl has some false positives. Risperidone, ziprasidone, I believe trazodone. There's a couple of other things that can cross-react with the fentanyl assay. So if you have a fentanyl positive, you really need to confirm that to see if it's really fentanyl. And now if somebody comes in and they say they're using fentanyl and you have a clinical picture where it's consistent with an opioid, I'm not necessarily going to confirm that. But if someone's surprised and didn't have the clinical effects, it could be just that it's part of the prescription medication. I think I'll stop there because that's a lot in that answer already.
I just want to break it down and summarize. So I think it's important for people to remember that opiates are different than opioids. So opiates are things that are kind of naturally derived from poppy, and opioids are more of our synthetic, semi-synthetic, and depending on your institution, the opioid panel could vary a little bit with what it's trying to detect. And then in my practice, once I have the screen, if I'm opting to send it for a confirmation, oftentimes what we'll get is kind of like a long list of metabolites from the opiate or oxycodone. And then in my practice, what I do is I go online and I pull up an opioid metabolism chart, because to be honest, I can't remember these things because I just don't have enough room in my brain. And I also don't want to misinterpret it, because as you just alluded to, there are many different pathways and that these can be broken down into each other. So I'll take a look at the metabolites, and first I'll just compare it to what they're taking, you know, like, is this possible? I'll sort of backtrack the metabolism based on one of the charts. So I'll start at the end and I'll sort of backtrack that way. And if it does, wonderful. And if there's something that I'm like, this is a little unexpected, I'm having a hard time picturing like how this metabolite could be present, you know, then I often will go back to the patient and kind of have a conversation and explore that a little bit more.
I do that too. I don't know if there's an easy, there's no trick that we don't know of that's the, other than looking, staring very carefully at the arrows on the metabolites. And is there a trick that we don't know of, Tim?
You know, you really do need to understand the metabolites, but you can, you know, when even with the metabolites, you can have, you understand as, you know, metabolism to a small amount or, you know, relatively, because you can differentiate potentially, you know, concomitant use with metabolism if you understand the ratios. That starts to get more complex, you know, versus if you have, for example, morphine and hydromorphone present. One of the take-homes is the lab report is not going to necessarily tell you that, oh, this is a normal metabolite, or this result is consistent with somebody taking whatever prescription that you're providing. There are labs that have toxicologists on call or people that can help interpret, but, you know, in general, if you have a question, you should reach out rather than, you know, having a patient interaction where something could go wrong or if there's any clinically important repercussions.
Yeah, don't be afraid to double check. I think I've called Natalie a number of times to be like, hey, can I just run through this with you to make sure that there's not alternative answers, not alternative options to that could explain this. So I think it's common and we should feel free to ask folks, you know, just to confirm our interpretation because they can be tricky.
I think especially when we know that there's a big consequence or if it's going to change a patient's experience or relationship, or those are the times where it's really important to know what the urine drug screen result says and what it doesn't say, because or the confirmatory test says or doesn't say.
Absolutely.
And another thing that I think can be challenging to interpret as well are like both positive and negative benzodiazepine screening assays. So for example, just to pose a scenario. So our patient here, he's been taking clonazepam. Okay. So he's on 0.5 milligrams once a day. And we get his, you know, urine test back and it shows actually a negative benzodiazepine on the screening test. So how would you interpret that for somebody who is taking, you know, a daily clonazepam?
So most of the benzodiazepine screens are specifically, the screening test is specifically targeted towards a chemical called oxazepam, which is a common metabolite for a number of benzodiazepines. But it's different enough from clonazepam, so clonazepam won't cross-react with that oxazepam assay. So I'd expect it to be negative in somebody, a standard benzodiazepine screen to be negative for somebody taking clonazepam. Now you need to look for clonazepams separately. So most labs are going to have, you know, if you're deciding what panel to order, you need to order clonazepam and a standard benzodiazepine screen. The benzodiazepine screens, we're in a world now of a lot of synthetic and designer benzodiazepines. Some people call them Xannies, press Xanax, counterfeit Xanax. You know, usually they've referred to them in the context of Xanax because that's probably the most common form as of the Xanax bar that's misrepresented synthetic or designer benzos. There's a lot of them out there. And, you know, unless the patient's getting it from a prescription, if they're using benzodiazepines in my area, they're often not getting real benzodiazepines. And so some of them will cross-react with the benzodiazepine screen, they are benzodiazepines usually. Other times there's other chemicals in that pressor counterfeit pill. Some of the designer benzos are different enough and they won't cross-react. So a positive benzodiazepine screen, assuming it's not the clonazepam screen, could be somebody using alprazolam or diazepam or chlorides epoxide, which is Librium, or they got midazolam in the emergency department, or it could be a designer benzodiazepine that reacts with the benzodiazepine screen. But on confirmation, you'd find that that would be typically negative. Or some of the false positives from benzodiazepine, sertraline, can cross-react with a benzodiazepine screen. A couple of other antidepressants infrequently can cross-react with a benzodiazepine screen as well. So that's how I'd interpret a positive screen. The negative screen in somebody taking clonazepam, I'd say you got to order clonazepam as a specific test to actually detect that.
Sertraline is surprisingly problematic as a false positive. Usually we think of it as a medication that doesn't interact with other medicines as much as other antidepressants. But for the screening, it seems to be, for the drug screening, it seems to cause problems more than others.
Absolutely, yeah. You have to confirm. So again, clinically significant interpretation, do the confirmatory test, and you'll at least find out if what you're looking for or what came up as the positive, is it truly the positive, or a different result shows up, and you know, it's a different benzodiazepine, then you have more than one, food for conversation.
Yeah, and for our patients, we end up sending confirmatory testing, and it actually demonstrates alpha-hydroxyalprazolam. So this would imply that the patient is probably being exposed to alprazolam overall. So I think my big take home here is kind of similar to our discussion around opiates and opioids. Make sure that if you're sending the confirmation test, that you know how to interpret the metabolites. And that's for the screening test for benzodiazepines, it's often for the metabolite oxazepam. So it's a little bit more limited, I think, in our ability to detect the full scope of benzodiazepines that we're currently seeing, you know, at least in our drug supply at this time, unfortunately.
Certainly alprazolam in this metabolite, alpha-hydroxy alprazolam is a metabolite of alprazolam. That's not clonazepam. So he's using alprazolam. But alprazolam and some other benzos will cross-react with the oxazepam assay. So, you know, somebody taking alprazolam, I'd expect it to be positive, not negative, unlike the clonazepam screen. And the same thing if they got midazolam in the emergency department, that'll usually cross-react. And when you do the confirmation, it'll show up as midazolam, or, you know, but that's something usually given in the emergency department or hospital setting.
And I think, too, sometimes I've noticed, and I'm curious in your thought, that cross-reactivity may be a bit dose-dependent as well. Yes. Like if a patient is regularly taking it, it's much more likely to cross-react and be positive versus I took it from a friend once on a flight because I was really anxious. I think I'm less likely, I think, to see that cross-react.
Yes, absolutely. It's not an absolute in small or lower concentrations, infrequent use. You have less risk. The cross-reactivity becomes from the immunoassay is picking up this chemical that is somewhat like the one it was targeted for. That means it's not going to be perfect. So you need a lot of it compared to what it's specifically matched with. So, you know, small amounts, less amounts, you're not going to be above a threshold of detection often. But, you know, if you got a high concentration, higher levels, then more likely to cross-react. Usually, these tests have been studied. So, you know, there is some data. Usually, you'd have to, if you're doing this in the clinic, you may have a point-of-care test. You can pull out the package insert and look at, you know, cross-reactivity information if you're so inclined. Usually, really small font, very small type. You have to read really detailed. So most people don't do that. Or you can, you know, later on at night, get on and look up cross-reactivity with benzodiazepine, you know, and find out, like looking at the drug testing and clinical addiction medicine document put out by ASAM, for example, is a lot of information about false positive cross-reactivity by analytes. A good resource for people to understand this area of drug testing.
I do want to know why in all these package inserts, the font is so small. I'm a nerd and I like reading the package inserts on the medications, on the urine drug screens. And I'm like, why is everything in like size 8 font consistently?
I think you'd have a book going home. You'd have, you know, 2 pounds of literature otherwise if it wasn't so small, probably.
So you mentioned that there's a good ASAM resource that you use? Are there other resources in the moment in clinic that when we're looking these things up, we have questions that you kind of direct trainees to or that you think are good to use for in terms of false positives or how you know where you find this information out?
Well, I think the two most common are from the ASAM. I mentioned drug testing and clinical addiction medicine. They also have a pocket guide, which is a condensed format and available through the ASAM website. It has as many of the pearls and take-homes from the much longer document included in the pocket guide. And I'll do a PubMed search if I'm really, you know, trying to figure out if something cross-reacts or pull a package insert, which takes some time. You have to really look at your sources and make sure, is this just a single case report? Is this, you know, is there other information? Where did this data and cross-reactivity come from? But that's really, you know, what I'll look for. And you already mentioned, opioid metabolism charts. There's a number of different tables from textbooks that you can pull out on different opioid metabolism. It's really important to understand that. It's important to understand that when you're interpreting any analyte and that has, potential for other drugs to show up as metabolites, and that opiates, benzodiazepines, those are the two most common. Amphetamines to some extent, I guess, methamphetamine, amphetamine, but that's, it doesn't go back and forth, for example, but important to understand the metabolism.
Great. And just to summarize and reinforce all the points that we've been talking about regarding our case, going back to the patient, just as a reminder, he is currently on buprenorphine, clonazepam, and recently on oxycodone for acute pain. And we obtain a urine drug screening test today, and it's positive for opiates, oxycodone, fentanyl, which we did add on separately, and cocaine. What are ways you would possibly interpret this test?
I'll break it apart by analyte because you have a lot of different ways that it could be interpreted. So if you have a positive fentanyl, if it's the initial positive screen, it could be because there's fentanyl, and it's truly fentanyl, or it could be because there's a cross-reactive substance, sertraline, risperidone, ziprasidone, trazodone, cross-reacting with the fentanyl assay. So sending confirmation important. Buprenorphine, there's not a lot of, buprenorphine is present as buprenorphine or metabolites, so it's important to, if you're looking for levels to confirm compliance or determine how much is there, or rule out spiked urine, getting the urine buprenorphine levels, we'll talk about that later. The opiate screen is looking for the morphine coating and then a couple of the synthetic opioids that are very close in structure to morphine and codeine, hydromorphone, hydrocodone. So a positive opiate screen could be morphine, could be codeine only turning into morphine, could be hydromorphone, hydrocodone, opium, could be the old heroin diacetylmorphine. I don't see that really anywhere where I practice right now. It's all fentanyl put in heroin now. The oxycodone or opioid screen, if you sometimes, and at least in the hospital work, we mentioned opioid screen. You can look for specific opioids, but on the point of care test, it's sometimes an opioid or oxycodone screen. If you're just talking about oxycodone, if oxycodone is there, it's usually oxycodone, but some naloxone and naltrexone can cross-react with the oxycodone screen. And then the cocaine. Cocaine is very, it's actually usually benzoecconine. You can test for cocaine, but cocaine is rapidly metabolized to benzoecconine. So usually the urine tests are this metabolite. And there's really not a lot of false positives for cocaine. It's generally pretty specific for cocaine as a metabolite if you have that. And I think those are all the positives. The negative benzos we already covered as well.
So we talked a little bit about medications that can cause false positives. So some of that I've heard you talk about are sertraline, the naltrexone. Are there other false positives, or what are the medicines that you most think of as these are the meds that are most likely to cause false positives, or that are a lot of patients are on that are most likely to cause false positives on urine drug screens?
Yeah, that's a good question. The most common is probably the amphetamine or methamphetamine analyte, and things like bupropion, it's a common antidepressant that can trigger a false positive amphetamine or methamphetamine screen, as can pseudoephedrine. So common decongestion or ephedrine. Now we don't really have ephedrine, but pseudoephedrine, the isomer. You can get a true positive from methamphetamine. Actually, it's available in some over-the-counter products as the nasal decongestant, the cartridge with menthol usually. I think it's only available as Vicks decongestant. But that actually has L-methamphetamine, which doesn't have psychoactive effects. It only causes vasoconstriction, affects the body. So that could be a true positive. So amphetamine is kind of a messy assay. A positive you have to confirm and then even understand something about the positive tests. And then sertraline is going to possibly cross-react the benzodiazepine assay. And then there's a couple of things that can cross-react with fentanyl. The opiates usually don't have false positives. Cocaine, not so much. Barbiturates, not really. We didn't talk about fencyclidine or PCP. I don't think that's on most of the tests that I use. Historically, that was a very common analyte and a point of care test, but more things cross react with fencyclidine than the risk of actually having a true positive. So I don't even like to have that included in any tests. I think cough medicine, dexamethorphan, carbamazepine, chlorpheniramine, cyclobenzaprine, the tricyclic antidepressants, venlafaxine, you can go on and on. You can almost wave your hand in air and get a false positive PCP test. So
it was on the panel at my last hospital, and people would always tell me, oh, it's positive for their screen was positive for PCP. And I'd say, you know, we're just going to assume that was a false positive until we hear otherwise. We can ask them let's still check in with them. Probably a false positive.
I think that's great. And on this point too, to just follow up, sometimes we do have patients with like unanticipated findings. They could be false positives. They could be false negatives. But how do you approach talking to patients with unanticipated findings in their urine test?
Yeah, good question. It really depends on the setting and the patient. I'm supportive, not accusatory. It's part of the clinical information that I'm getting. I have to understand really what, you know, the benefits of talking to the patient about letting them know, about my knowing. Sometimes there's really big implications for a patient for a true positive, and, you know, they're really upset about in use. And so, you know, by indicating that I know this is a positive, that can have a lot of meaning and important ramifications for the patient. So got to be very careful about that. It's not, you know, can be different than, giving somebody a hemoglobin A1C result. I mean, we don't have other areas of medicine that can be, you know, impacted with legal and, you know, other repercussions, CPS, you know, so those settings, you really have to be careful. And that's where really important to know your test results too. So not to jump to conclusions, but in general, these tests, and I'm using to help, you know, support a patient and to let them know how they're doing, to support recovery, and that it's part of the information, you know, not typically going to be the only result that, you know, I'm going to react on. So I try and preface when I'm doing a test, you know, again, it depends on the setting, because I'm in the ED in the hospital setting. I've had patients wake up from overdose where family found them, and, you know, the reaction is, I didn't use something. I don't know what happened. I must have been asleep or something. And we know that fentanyl showed up at high levels, and family's very upset, and the patient's very defensive. And, you know, so I'll have family leave. We'll talk to the patient. You know, it's kind of a conversation, you know, letting them know that, well, we gave you naloxone, or we woke you up. You know, that means there's an opioid there. We found fentanyl. And there's, so kind of telling them what we found rather than your drug screen was positive for fentanyl. I know, you know, so it's this kind of evolving dialogue with the patient. I think, you know, not being accusatory, not, you know, using the right terminology, not your drug test was dirty, you know, or your drug test was clean. You know, it's interesting. I find sometimes patients use that terminology, but, you know, I try to be scientific, and you know, the language has stigma and bias sometimes associated with it. We really don't want that, you know, to be pulled into our dialogues. So even if they're using it, I try and use the other, you know, appropriate terminology. And, you know, sometimes these talks can get emotional, and I just, you know, have to take a time out at times, redirect, and just reassure the patient that I'm there to help them. You know, a lot of times they'll say, I'm not here to cause any problems, or I'm here to help you feel better. I'm here to help this go well. And, you know, this is just part of the information. Or here's where I want to help you get to.
We haven't actually had a chance to talk about buprenorphine testing. So our patient is on buprenorphine, naloxone, on 16 milligrams a day. And we did decide that we wanted to send out a confirmatory test and check his buprenorphine quant levels. So they came back with a buprenorphine level of like 400 and a norbuprenorphine level of 900. So how would you interpret his like bup, norbup levels?
So you've got buprenorphine, which is the primary drug, buprenorphine, it's metabolized to norbuprenorphine. It's also metabolized to something called a conjugate, buprenorphine glucuronide, and then norbuprenorphine glucuronide. And the labs will sometimes report all of those, which is the free buprenorphine, and then the conjugates, and then the total, or sometimes they'll just report the total. So the buprenorphine here, I'm assuming, is the total buprenorphine, meaning buprenorphine plus the buprenorphine glucuronide, and then the norbuprenorphine is the norbuprenorphine plus the norbuprenorphine glucuronide. And that's important because if normally buprenorphine is not in the 400s unless you have this conjugate, this glucuronide. So this is the normal profile. Typically, I would say, yeah, this patient has a lot of metabolite. They have, a moderate amount of the parent drug. If we're looking at just the free drugs, that's too much buprenorphine. It could be where the patient was, but they'd still have a lot of metabolite. For just the free drug, you could say, well, you mean they're taking it? Maybe they were worried they missed a dose, put a little bit in their urine, but that probably not in this case. It's probably just the total, and this is somebody taking it appropriately.
And just overall, do you have any other tips or thoughts about other indications that a urine drug screen like may have been modified by a patient, like maybe a patient's not on buprenorphine? Any other things that you're looking for?
Yeah, this is called specimen validity testing, which is really an important part of drug testing. I think it's not emphasized. We often talk about false positives, false negative, cross-reactive, presumptive, confirmatory. The specimen validity testing is making sure that the sample is actually valid. And it could be invalid because not enough was taken, a quantity. It could be invalid because, if you do an oral test, that not enough time and not enough saliva was taken. So it doesn't have enough IgG or doesn't have enough saliva to actually pick up the drug that might be in the saliva. So there's different markers that often are included on the lab report. Sometimes if I'm helping get a test, I can also tell part of my obtaining the sample might even be part of the specimen validity testing, like holding to see if the temperature's consistent with body temperature. There might be a little marker or the temperature strip on the side of a urine test, but I can't read those. I mean, I can't tell if the color changes. So I can tell that that's body temperature just by holding it, or is this ice cold? Usually specimen validity testing, we're looking at urine creatinine. Is this really too dilute or too concentrated? If it's outside of the normal physiologic window, it's not a valid specimen for measuring the drug level or just for doing the testing, the drug testing. And that could be because it's too dilute. And there could be physiologic reasons that it's too dilute. But, that tells me that specimen's not valid. I need to figure out why. Or it could be because somebody added a lot of water or apple juice to the sample in the bathroom. Or it could be they drank a ton of Mountain Dew to try and, get really dilute urine and drive the concentration of whatever they think they're worried about below a threshold of detection. So they're auto-diluting the sample. Sometimes people have added things to the urine, acid or alkaline to destroy the metabolites and drugs. So we look at the urine pH. So the pH should be within a normal range. Urine pH is not 2 or it's not 12. That's not physiologic. That would cause a lot of problems coming out of the body. If the specimen isn't valid, and any interpretation beyond, that point is not valid either. So that's really important. There's some challenges in doing this, if it's really important, like the physician health programs, they're in the bathroom watching the physician, do the urination. So they know it's a valid specimen coming from that moment. If this is sports and drug testing, the Olympics, they're drug testing personnel, they're watching the athlete urinate. They have a limited amount of water, needs to come from the drug testing volunteer. They need to provide a sample with a window of detection. You do this in an outpatient treatment program. You're working with patients doing an observed specimen. That can be problematic. History of trauma, sexual trauma, that can be really intrusive and problematic. Going into the bathroom to watch, people who have shy bladders, that can also be challenging. You don't want to, sit there for 20 minutes with somebody who gets really uncomfortable and decides, screw this. I'm not coming back to treatment. I don't want to do this anymore. So we try and minimize the intrusion and make it part of the clinical practice without being, causing problems with patient care. And then we do other things to try and, is this reasonable specimen? Sometimes I mix up, if you have the opportunity to do some oral tests in their space with the urine test, that could be useful because then you can, match them to the urine sometimes if you have that capability. You don't have to do that all the times, but sometimes that's a good a check. The oral test sometimes too. During COVID, we weren't doing a lot of drug tests. Come back to still doing some now on site, but you can do the oral tests through telemedicine. Watch the patient do an oral test through the camera. They can take the test themselves, seal it in while on the video, and close it, put it back in the box and put it in the mail. I mean, there's still maybe some problems with that, but you can't do that when somebody's going to the bathroom on video. That's a problem. So some benefits with doing the oral testing. But yeah, you want to get the specimen validity testing is really important in understanding, how it could be manipulated or what might be out of bounds or invalidated specimen is important component of drug testing.
My institution actually has switched mostly to oral testing, which it's been interesting because it has its benefits and some parts that are just, it's a change for me. Yeah. So you mentioned one thing is that there's less, THC doesn't show up for, stay as long positive. Are there other quick pearls or tips that people like me should know? Is there a different, the buprenorphine, norbuprenorphine, are there other really important things that are very different in terms of how we test for substances or how we look at results for saliva?
Yeah, really good question. So a couple things. Buprenorphine, you can just tell if it's there. You don't get a metabolite profile. Somebody taking a piece of buprenorphine film right before the test, it's going to show up positive. And, I've had a patient do an observed dose and then pop the oral test right in while it's in, hey, I didn't mean you to do that. So it just tells you if it's there. I've also seen the oral tests that can have false negative buprenorphine. This may be because you didn't get enough specimen. If somebody has, we give patients a lot of medications that cause dry mouth. Plus they smoke, or vape, maybe dehydrated, maybe on clonidine or an antihistamine, which is anticholinergic, which dries the mouth out, or four other drugs that do the same thing, quetiapine, bupropion, clonidine, diphenhydramine, hydroxyzine. Getting a saliva sample out of a patient like that can be really challenging. And it's not like wipe the mouth and you're done. It's sitting there holding it and 10 minutes later, is it done yet? Because it has to, they have a little bittering agent or a little salt on the end, so it stimulates saliva, but it has to pull the saliva up through the little tube and then the blue, if you've had yours, if you've seen these, that usually it's blue change. It's like, God, is that blue yet? Oh, for Christ's sake, is this thing working? And I was like, maybe that
really
one's not good.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and then I've had patients too. They're pretty determined not to let it touch the cheeks. I'm like, oh my God. It's like, are you sure that's touching your cheek? And then there are ways of invalidating. There's artificial saliva, peroxide, alcohol, that can invalidate. It seems like some of them, the thresholds for detection for cocaine can go longer for the oral, whereas THC may go lower. And then buprenorphine, unless somebody's taking it right away, I've definitely seen false negatives with buprenorphine doing the saliva test and urine quantification. You don't see that. So I think the false negatives is just people aren't getting a good specimen. Some of the tests will look for IgG, enough IgG to show that that's a valid sample in oral testing. Like we use urine creatinine, urine specific gravity for the urine, the IgG and the saliva. But you got to get a good enough sample, enough saliva. It takes time, can be challenging to get that in some patients.
I've learned so much from this conversation. I feel like it was just a whirlwind 101 of how to interpret these tests. Do you have any main take-home points that you want our listeners to walk home with today?
So if you're working in a hospital's ED clinic setting, find out, what's included on your panel. And because sending a drug test may not pick up things that are important. We talked about fentanyl. Fentanyl in my hospital, our lab working with the outpatient clinic has panels where that's included, but others, you need to add that to the panel. So, a negative screen may not be truly negative for common substances used in their area. There's often also even add-ons that are available, but you have to add on like buprenorphine or methadone, or we talked about clonazepam. The common false positives for amphetamine, bupropion, benzodiazepine, sertraline, they come up all the time. Almost a week doesn't go by where I don't get a call from, recently I had a call from OB that was a resident was involved in a case where mom was being monitored, had a baby. There's positive amphetamine screens, has a history of amphetamine use, but now is on bupropion. positive screen was interpreted really quickly, and you know, CPS got involved, but it, you know, they hadn't confirmed that it was really amphetamine or methamphetamine there, and she was on bupropion. So, you know, we had a discussion, said, you need to confirm that. I mean, she's on a medication that can be positive for that. So know what the false positives are. Understand specimen validity testing and how to apply that in your practice. And there may be some things you can do, or at least understand, you know, like when a specimen is not valid, that it throws off the interpretation and looking, oh, that's too dilute. So I've got to get another sample or understand, you know, what might have caused that. And then the resources, know where to go for resources. I mentioned the drug testing in clinical addiction medicine. You talked about the opioid metabolism charts. They think those are useful resources as well. So it's great to do this tonight, but because this doesn't really come up in medical education, whether you're medical school, residency, yet physicians, healthcare providers are considered the experts. And this doesn't really come up in training, addiction medicine training, maybe to some extent. But even in addiction medicine training, there's, you know, unless there's people that are experts and really, really focusing on it, there's a lot of nuances. There's a lot of nuances that are important to understand.
Do you have anything that you'd like to plug for our audience?
I moderate a webinar. I'm a medical toxicologist and addiction specialist. We have a webinar that's held the first Friday of the month from 1 to 2, available to the public. It's jointly sponsored by the American College of Medical Toxicology and the American Society of Addiction Medicine. It's the Addiction Toxicology Case Conference. I have panelists from medical toxicologists, addiction specialists, as well as sometimes non-addiction specialists, palliative care, pain, OB-GYN, emergency medicine, critical care that come in, and we talk about dissect cases usually on a monthly basis, usually two cases. There's a variety of recorded sessions on the websites, or you can join us through ASAM or ACMT. You can go to the website. We can provide the link. That's the first Friday of the month from 1 to 2 Eastern Standard Time.
That's great. We'll be sure to put that link in our show notes for folks who are interested. Thank you so much today for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Carolyn. Thanks, Natalie. It was a pleasure to be here.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders miniseries, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get show notes at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. A special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project, as well as ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about the organization at acam.org. A special thanks to our team for this episode, including our editor, Dr. Kento Sonata, and to our whole team. The Curbsiders is produced and edited by the team at PodPaste.
And just a friendly reminder that this and most of our episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And until next time, I've been Carolyn Chan.
And I'm Natalie Stahl. Thanks for joining us today and letting us bring you some addiction medicine pearls.